From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. Occasionally in this segment, we explore how technology affects the way we relate to each other. All Tech producer Shireen Meraji looks at how technology is changing the breakup, just in time for Valentine's Day.
Gigi Quintana is a veteran of breaking hearts in the age of social networking. She recently parted ways with a girlfriend.
It was an 8-month, 9-month relationship.
And says putting an end to their online connection was just as difficult as the breakup itself. Her Facebook status said in a relationship, so she deleted it. But that's not all.
You know, I blocked her sister. I blocked everyone that knew her. And she is still friends with my friend, so I had to go to the extent of blocking her.
Quintana was on a smoke break from her coffee shop job at a place called Tryst. It's full of people surfing the net, and quite a few had an opinion about what it's like to break up when you're virtually tied to your ex by Twitter, Tumblr, LinkedIn, Delicious, MySpace, Flickr, Foursquare, and Facebook.
My name's Daisy Montague. An ex-boyfriend contacted me and then wanted to be friends, so then we were friends on Facebook, and then his wife didn't want me to be friends with him anymore.
First name is Omar, last name is Musri. I enjoy not having to tell the entire world your business. One moment. Large skin mocha.
David Muse. If I'm no longer in a relationship with you, I don't need to check up on you. And especially after we break up, why do I need to go and see what you're doing?
Okay, so David Muse may not need to check up on his exes. Not Paul Monday. He's a blogger and avid social networker. And he sums up this digital impulse with the analog phrase, driving by.
Where you don't unfriend, or they have not toned down their privacy settings, and you drive by the other person's profile, and you look at it, and you just, it's basically like stabbing yourself in the heart again every 4 hours or something, you know?
Monday has an ex-wife, an ex-fiancé, and a 9-year-old son, and they're all on Facebook. But they're not all Facebook friends. So when Facebook suggested Paul's son friend his ex-fiancé,
It's sort of like getting hit with a bat to have an ex-fiancé and an ex-wife. Myself, all in this forum centered around my son was just, I think, too overwhelming for me. And to respect everyone, I actually said no to him.
The absolutely tricky part about this is that it's very hard to unspool these relationships once they have begun without absolutely destroying the digital person that you have become.
Lee Rainey's the director of Pew's Internet and American Life Project. He studies the way the internet affects how we live and relate to one another.
Don't go public with your so-called private life.
Relationship advice guru Judith Martin, better known as Miss Manners, weighs in.
You know, I was talking about this with my daughter, and she said, George Orwell's 1984 has come about, but it's not them doing it to us. It's us doing it to ourselves. We're watching ourselves every minute and posting everything out there. Change your password, folks, and don't go snooping around on the internet on purpose.
21-year-old Kella Vangsness is trying to follow Miss Manners' old-school advice. She recently broke up with her guy and decided to quit Facebook and Twitter altogether to speed up the healing process.
I mean, I can't imagine life without it, but I have been off it for almost a week, and I'm doing fine.
Long gone are the days when you could throw the ex's toothbrush in the trash and burn the shoebox of photo evidence of your once happy coupledom. Shireen Meraji, NPR News.
Online relationship rules are still being written, but there's one rule that has made an easy transition from the analog to the digital world. Sex sells.
As we continue our pre-Valentine's Day All Tech Considered, we're going to hear now about a romantic comedy that never made it to the big screen.
But it has been watched by millions on desktops and laptops.
Okay, you understand. We don't want boyfriends, we don't want boyfriends, we don't want relationships. We want two guys to service us. This is Strictly Sexual.
The name of the film is Strictly Sexual. It's about two working professional women who've given up on relationships and decide to employ a couple of gigolos to fill the void.
Really, the movie is about love and intimacy. And if I were to title the film Love and Intimacy, I'm sure people would think it was pretentious and never watch it.
Director Stevie Long adds that it's not a porn flick. In fact, there's no nudity in his film whatsoever.
Yet Strictly Sexual is the most watched movie of all time on Hulu.com. No stars are in it, and even though it never had a theatrical release, Long got it into the hands of a company that distributes films on cable and the internet.
I woke up one morning and found a dozen or so messages in my Facebook inbox, you know, saying, hey, I just saw this film and, you know, it really touched me and I love the way it talks about breakups and relationships. And I just kind of scratched my head saying, where'd you see my movie? You know, I had no idea actually what Hulu was. God bless, you know, the people who had the foresight to put it up there.
Hulu, for those who still don't know, is an incredibly popular video streaming website. One online measurement service, ComScore, reported that more than a billion videos were watched on Hulu in December 2009 alone.
It carries some movies and a lot of popular television shows, Lost, The Office, Family Guy. Long figures that people stumbled upon his film on Hulu while catching up on their favorite TV shows.
We were hoping, you know, in a perfect world that, you know, it would open on 2,000 screens, that, you know, a Harvey Weinstein would put it all across America. We were fortunate in that the timing of the internet and the ability for people to watch movies came about at the same time. I didn't have an ego about it. As an artist, I just wanted my movie to be seen.
Hulu won't provide an exact view count for Strictly Sexual, but there are enough people watching to make Stevie Long a profit through commercials embedded with the movie.
I'll give it to you in these rough terms. The film, the $100,000 film, has made 10 times its money.
Enough to fund Long's next independent film.
It's a tragic tale. It's about people in the porn industry and the denial that goes on there. We've appropriately titled it Porn Star, The Ugly Life of a Beautiful Girl. And I'd like to think a lot of people are going to click on that title.
Whether they click on it or not, Long has already proven that the internet is a place where independent filmmakers can thrive.
If the title is right. Don't forget to go to our All Tech Considered blog, where you'll find quirky tech stories you can't help but read.
That's npr.org/alltech. This is NPR News.
When New Yorker writer Peter Hessler applied for a Chinese driver's license, he entered a world where, as he puts it, nothing could be taken for granted. For example, here's one question from a Chinese written driver's exam. If another motorist stops to ask you directions, you should
A. not tell him, B. reply patiently and accurately, or C. tell him the wrong way.
Peter Hessler got his license in 2001 in the early stages of China's auto boom. An average of 1,000 new drivers were registering each day in Beijing alone. Hessler spent 7 years driving himself around China to see how the car was transforming the country. His new book, Country Driving, starts with his 7,000-mile trip following the Great Wall across rural northern China.
And along the way, I would stop in villages, and I mean, it was really, you know, sort of sad because so many of these places are losing population to the south. I mean, this is basically the story of today's China, is that you have an estimated 140 million people who have left the countryside to work in factory towns, work on construction crews. And you really notice this when you drive through these little villages. I mean, often the only people you see, you know, are very old people who can no longer work, or the children, the youngest people who are still too young to go out to find jobs.
You end up renting a house in a small village, a village called Sansha, which is just a couple of hours from Beijing by car. This is back in 2002. A couple of hours from Beijing, but light years away, really, in what it was like when you started living there.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the reasons I got a license, was that I sort of... Beijing could be a little overwhelming. I mean, it's a city of 13 million people and really intense to live in the downtown area. And I wanted to have a way to escape periodically. And I always have liked rural China and smaller parts of China. So I wanted to find a place to rent on the outskirts. And so with a friend, I was just driving around and we happened to come to a village at the end of a road. And, I mean, it really was a world away. I mean, the road was a dirt road that went to the village. Population was about 150 people. I guess when I moved in, there were still two old women in the village who had bound feet. So, you know, there are ways in which it was, you know, it was like going back in time.
But then very quickly, things change. There's a paved road that comes to Sansha. And what happens then?
This is really sort of the story of so many places in China. I mean, you know, we have a huge automobile boom in China, but a big part of that is the improvement in infrastructure and roads. And when I moved to Sansha, the village, in 2001, it had that dirt road, and it felt very sleepy and very isolated from the city. And they paved the road the next year, and the changes were really immediate and quite sweeping in the sense that suddenly people from Beijing could make it out here pretty easily. They're exploring the countryside. They're visiting sections of the Great Wall. And this village is right on the Great Wall. And so people would show up. And a number of villagers began to engage in business. They'd open up, you know, a small restaurant or guest house. And, you know, and in the period of a few years, you had just massive changes in that place.
You know, we may look at that and think that something has been lost. I'm not sure that the people in Sansha would have any great nostalgia for the way things were before, though.
Certainly not. And you don't see that much in China. I mean, I don't think that people have this sort of yearning for the past because, and especially in places like that, I mean, these are people that knew poverty. I mean, when I moved in there, the average income in 2001 was about $250, and within a span of 5 years, that had increased to about $800, more than $800. So it's a big change for them. And for them, this is a 100% a positive thing. They don't have nostalgia for the old days.
Did you see a downside, though?
I did. You know, I think as a foreigner, your perspective is different. And, you know, I guess one thing that I really noticed is that I think when there is this rapid pace of change that we've seen in China, it puts a lot of pressure on people. They're continually having to adjust to new opportunities, new situations, new challenges. You know, and actually there's a family that I became very close with. Their name is Wei. And the Wei family, they were some of the most successful people in the village. Their income eventually went to, you know, to over $8,000 a year, which is really a huge amount in rural China. And they became the most successful people in the village. But one thing I noticed was that it didn't make them any healthier. That was one of the most striking things. For example, the father, he became a very heavy smoker because in China, that's what middle-class people do. He had never smoked when he was just a farmer. But now that he was doing business in China, you smoke if you're doing business because you give cigarettes to, you know, to clients and to guests and to people that you're doing business with. And their son, you know, sort of changed in the span of 2 years from being a very, you know, scrawny, active peasant kid, basically, to a child who had 75 channels on cable television because the village got cable television, and he gained weight rapidly. It's sort of, you could sort of see what happens in America over generations happening within a span of 5 years there.
You end your book in the industrial south of China in a factory city that basically springs up before your eyes. It's Lishui. And there's an expressway that stitches together these cities that are all built around one industry. There's one city that makes buttons. There's one that makes playground equipment. You find a factory with my favorite product, I think, the Jane Eyre electrical outlet covers. But you ultimately focus on two men who are trying to get a factory up and running, and you can't at first figure out what it is that they're trying to make. What does it end up being?
Yeah, I mean, and this is an area where people are just, they make things in incredible scale. I mean, you mentioned that button town. I mean, that's a, you know, it's a town that only has about 60,000 people in it, but they have 380 different factories, and they make 70% of the buttons that are used in China for clothes made in China. And, you know, there's another town I went through where they make playing cards, and they make about 1 billion decks of playing cards every year in this one town. And that's, you know, half of China's market. You know, there's a place in China that makes 1/3 of the socks on earth. So, you know, everybody's manufacturing in this part of the south. And I got to know these guys while they were designing a factory, and they weren't very clear on what they made. And you sort of see all this energy going into the creation of this factory. I saw them design it, and they're installing machinery. And then we finally start to talk about the product, and I realize that it's a little ring, nylon-covered steel ring that connects to the strap of a brassiere. And this is what these guys are making. It's, you know, it weighs less than half a gram. It's 1.2 millimeters thick. But this is, you know, this is their product, and this is all they're going to be making in this factory. And it's, you know, you sort of realize all of this energy. This is a huge amount of investment from these two people. They have all these workers. They've got a big space. They're getting all this equipment. And it's all going to create something that we would take for granted. the thing I took away from that is that, you know, pretty much every little thing that we're buying, even the pieces of things, to somebody in China, that is an entire world of ambition and competition, of risk and opportunity. You know, it became sort of an epic struggle for them to, you know, to stay afloat. They ended up making it. You know, they became successful. But over the 2 years that I followed them, I mean, it was a really hard road for them.
Peter Hessler's book is titled Country Driving, A Journey Through China from Farm to Factory. Peter Hessler, thanks very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to NPR.
In Canada, enthusiastic crowds have turned out to watch the Olympic torch on its cross-country journey. Its final destination, the opening ceremony of the Winter Olympics this Friday. The crowds are a little less enthusiastic in the host city of Vancouver. As NPR's Martin Costi reports, they're downright ambivalent.
You can't turn on a TV in Canada these days without being told how excited Canadians are getting. Just ask native son Donald Sutherland.
From the smallest hamlets to the biggest towns, Canadians everywhere are starting to believe.
Well, not all Canadians.
Veto the Olympics, burn the Olympics, trash the Olympics.
Mark Cooper sits outside a Vancouver Starbucks, nursing a coffee and yelling his unsolicited opinion at anyone he sees wearing an official Olympic jacket.
It's a total waste of our money, taxpayers' money.
Cooper's crankiness is extreme, but what's remarkable is how little backtalk he gets. The fact is, recent polling shows enthusiasm is declining. Only about 50% of British Columbians now see the Games as positive. Margot Young, a University of BC law professor and longtime Olympic critic, says spiraling costs are partly to blame. But she says it's not just the money that's souring the public mood.
It's just this sort of corporate rollout of this particular mind-numbing Olympic mentality.
Vancouver is Canada's San Francisco, and the city's liberal tendencies have been running headlong into the Olympic organizers' increasing control over daily life.
They want everybody to be smiling hosts and, you know, gladly not drive their cars for 2 weeks and put up with their business suffering for those 2 weeks, all for the greater good, which is the Olympics. And I guess for many people, the greater good isn't good enough.
And then there's all the security. Nearly 1,000 new surveillance cameras and thousands of extra law enforcement officers from around the province, many of them staying on cruise ships docked in the harbor. Here on Vancouver's seedy east side, many locals welcome the extra cops. But others say the security is turning into harassment. Harsha Walia is with an activist organization called the Olympic Resistance Network, which has been trying to disrupt the Olympic torch relay. She says she's had visits from plainclothes police.
If they say they want to talk, you tell them they don't. You shut the door. They try to force their way in. And
they tried to push their way in?
Twice they did. Twice as I was shutting the door, they tried to open up the door.
The head of security for the Olympics, Bud Mercer, confirms that he has teams gathering information on certain people. But he rejects the claims of harassment.
I think there's some individuals that like to hear themselves speak, and they're using the media for that. But anybody that we speak to, there's a reason for it. It's not harassment. If they don't want to answer us, that's their choice, and we move on.
Mercer says anti-Olympics protests will be tolerated outside the venues. But if things get raucous, Mercer may find it hard to do his job without offending Vancouverites' traditional tolerance of dissent. And that tolerance is remarkable. You see it even in the most diehard Olympic fans, and there are plenty of them here.
Really good mood. Yeah.
People like these Olympic volunteers who've been waiting for hours in a line that wraps around the block just for a chance at a free ticket. All it gets them is a look at a rehearsal of the opening ceremony, but Ursula Fisher and her friends are still thrilled.
I love the Olympics. It's a once in a lifetime. Why not enjoy it?
And yet, for all her enthusiasm, Fisher says she doesn't mind the anti-Olympics protesters. It's a sentiment that's echoed farther down the line by Diane Fox and Lynn Williams.
We're not going to let it spoil our fun.
No.
So, and they have a right.
We're very mellow about those kind of things.
And that's Canada. Even when people disagree, somehow they manage to keep things mellow. Martin Costi, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. A cinematic battle is brewing between a tribe of 9-foot-tall blue-skinned creatures.
Naughty.
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 And a girl who tumbles down a rabbit hole.
Alice.
Avatar and Alice in Wonderland will soon be competing for space on 3D screens in movie theaters. Alice, directed by Tim Burton, will be released on March 5th. Trouble is, Avatar is still doing great at the box office. It's the highest grossing film in history. And if you're a theater owner, you may not want to give up on that proven cash cow. John Foreman is confronting that dilemma. He's president of Cleveland Cinemas, which has 9 theaters with 75 screens, mostly around Cleveland. And Mr. Foreman, how many 3D screens do you have?
We have 5 3D screens, but that's between all the different theater locations. And as your introduction just suggested, we'd like to have more in the near future to be able to handle the current popularity of seeing films in this 3D format.
So when you're thinking about this collision at the movie theater there, which movie you will keep on those 3D screens, how do you make that decision?
Well, in our case, we had made a prior commitment to the Alice in Wonderland, as many people have as well. So we will unfortunately have to give up a very successful engagement of Avatar in favor of Alice.
Would you have thought going in that you would have this calendar problem of a movie like Avatar doing so great in 3D that you'd be bumping up against Alice in Wonderland also in 3D and having to choose?
I don't think anyone thought, it's a wonderful problem to have, but it really does call attention to what's going on in the exhibition and distribution business of motion picture pictures throughout the United States currently.
What's involved in converting to 3D? How much of an investment is that?
It's a significant investment. To convert a traditional 35-millimeter auditorium that shows films using celluloid, it's about a $100,000 investment, and that's give or take depending on the kind of equipment you use and the whistles and bells, but it's less if you're just converting to 2D digital.
So $100,000 to make the conversion. How does that break down?
Well, there's the cost of a server, a digital projector, a silver screen, and the whatever apparatus you're using to create the 3D effect. There are different manufacturers who have different 3D systems.
When you think about investing in this, how have you decided which theaters get it and which ones don't?
Well, it's really more a matter of how soon a theater is going to get it as opposed to who's going to get it and who will not. And there probably are no less than 20 films coming out the remainder of 2010 in a 3D format. And the conflict you just referred to, if a film is popular, you need to have more than one 3D screen available. So it's here and it's happening, and it's happening very quickly.
Do you wonder, though, Mr. Foreman, if moviegoers are going to get tired of this, just don't want to pay higher prices, don't want to put on the glasses, and this wave will crest?
In a word, yes, I do wonder. I think that, you know, the Cinerama experience of years ago was unique, and it disappeared, and this is something that's new and different and very popular right now. I don't know how long it'll last, and do you want to go see A Single Man in 3D? Probably not, but I think that for right now, it's going to remain popular, and I hope that right now is a good 5 to 10 years, because that's how long it's going to take to get your return on your investment or pay down your debt on what it's going to cost to convert your theater.
John Foreman, thanks very much.
Thank you.
John Foreman is president of Cleveland Cinemas.